a free thinker whose speech blighted his political ambitions, Cowie's father left a large impression on almost everybody but his son. "I knew your father, boy," these men would say, which put them one up on Cowie. He could neither say that he did or did not. A big man, he spent most of his time in a small room lined with law books, blue with cigar smoke and the fumes from a coal oil stove. Cowie's mother did not feel that this air, or the men who breathed it, were good for him. His father swore freely. He sometimes drank whiskey from a glass tumbler in which he kept his sharpened, indelible pencils. Bold with men, Harrison Cowie was ill at ease with women in general, speechless with the one he had married. Of his father's voice, Cowie remembered two phrases that covered every situation. "Yes, Belle," and more softly, "No, Belle." If the weather and his health permitted, his father harnessed a dappled mare every morning and drove a buggy to his office. The traffic obliged him to give this up. Toward his father, Cowie's feelings were profound but vague, as toward the Almighty. Harrison Cowie's feelings toward his son, if his son judged them correctly, were those of Joseph toward the son of Mary. He was pleased and proud, but he seemed to doubt that he had done it himself. Cowie's uncle, Michael Ahern, was a small Irishman from Duluth. How explain the large impression he made on Cowie? Their gaze was almost on the level the summer they met. Cowie's feet were larger. Mr. Ahern sometimes wore Cowie's buckle overshoes. Unlike most small men, Mr. Ahern's movements were not quick, but deliberate. His walk was slow, he ate slowly, taking his time. This explained nothing about him, really, but it made a large impression on Cowie. This impression did not shrink as Cowie grew bigger, nor did it fade as he grew older. To explain it, it was necessary to consider the nature of Mr. Ahern's life. It was upside down, or perhaps a better term was bass-ackward. His wife, Martha, used that word since she considered the proper word vulgar. "Just remember," she would say to Cowie, "that your daddy leads a bass-ackward life." Now, he was not, of course, Cowie's father at all. But he certainly led a bass-ackward life. This was not the normal state of things in Des Moines. Shortly after supper, his cigar in his mouth, his lunch in a brown paper bag under his arm, Mr. Ahern walked, if the weather permitted, to his work. He was a pressman, one of those who made it possible to read the morning paper. Between 4 and 5 in the morning, he brought it home with him unread. It was late in the afternoon before he got around to reading it. Summer and winter, Mrs. Ahern would get up and make him a snack or a cup of coffee, which didn't trouble his sleep at all, but put an end to hers. If she went back to bed, it was just to lie there, so in the summer she would stay up and iron. The windows open, the draft through the house would bring the smell of the iron, of the sprinkled clothes, of the scorched smell of the starch to where Cowie lay on the day bed in the living room. The creak of the ironing board would sometimes put him to sleep, sometimes keep him awake. She liked to iron in her slip, the bottom pinned up so the draft would blow cool on her legs. Her hair piled up like a turban so it would also blow cool on her neck. She did not trust ironing to the laundry. Cowie's shirts were in a special problem due to the shortness of his neck, which flattened the collars and made the points curl up. Pins worn to support the tie did not help. His Aunt Martha took pride in Cowie's appearance and never let him wear his shirt more than 3 times. And straightened the lines in his black stockings when he left the house. The paper lining was also left in his cap. Boys who wore caps pulled over one ear were only fit to be Western Union messengers, who sooner or later got into trouble with waitresses. Half of his life, Cowie envied Western Union boys who flew past him, furiously pumping, their butts wagging on the high saddles as they raced off toward forbidden pleasures with waitresses. On his mind's eye, all waitresses led a double life. The room in which Kawi slept contained the sofa, which opened out into a day bed, a matching chair and rocker with hardwood arms, a canary in a cage that was usually hooded, a walnut Victrola with two albums of records on the shelf below. The daybed had a high and low side, one concave, the other convex. Kawi's choice was usually determined by the nature of the weather. In the summer, he slept high to feel the draft. In the winter, he slept curled up in the hollow. The bedding was stored in a place beneath the seat. It was Kawi's chore to make this bed, store the pilling and bedding beneath it when he got back from school in the afternoon, and Mr. Ahern was up and awake. Unless it was Sunday and Mr. Ahern's day off, the blinds in the living room were kept drawn to keep the daylight out of the house. It gave this room the dim, subdued tone of a small funeral parlor, strongly scented with Mrs. Ahern's O-Cedar oil. In the winter, Mr. Ahern might sit for an evening reading his popular mechanics magazine or the new Sears and Roebuck catalog, with a gas jet hissing warmly above his head. He wore his black hair short as a safety measure, since he often put his head into the wheels of the machinery. There was a crease in his scalp from his snug-fitting cap. Somehow it was all right for Mr. Ahern to wear a cap without earmuffs or paper lining, but it was not all right for Kawi with his big ears. Mr. Ahern's head was small, with blue veins prominent in the temples and small, knotty lumps of muscles where he worked his jaws. Several gold teeth ornamented his infrequent smile. He was a man of simple taste, but every simple taste had to be the best. The lightweight underwear he wore, summer and winter, came by mail from a specialty house in Chicago, which also supplied him with his official night watchman comfort shoes. The first sign of Mr. Ahern being up and about was the sound of these shoes being polished, the cloth snapping like a whip at the end of the stroke, and the smell of the wax strong in the kitchen. On the dresser in the bedroom, where it ticked loudly, he would put out his non-magnetic railroad watch, on its chain with a small gold knife that he used to clean the grease from his nails. Until he had shaved at the kitchen window, where just his lathered head showed above the curtain, he wore his snug whipcord pants with the straps of his braces dangling, his underwear unbuttoned to expose the crinkly hair on his chest. Nothing could have been more commonplace, but it left on Kawi a durable impression. No ordinary mortal arose so late in the day and walked around as he did, wearing harness, as if unhitched from the work he had accomplished while asleep. After shaving, Mr. Ahern might sit on the porch in a cloud of the smoke from his first white owl. He smoked three, one before and two after supper. Mrs. Ahern would stand at the screen in her apron and chat with him. She felt that a man who worked underground like a mole should sit for a while where the sun could get at him. His complexion was sallow. His underwear had more color than he had himself. All that sitting in the sun did to him, however, was to make him squint his eyes. On his nights off, his hobby was to measure such things as a hair from Cowie's head or the wing of a fly with his micrometer. Cowie's hair always proved to be thicker, but that was small wonder. Mrs. Ahern could have told him that she did without tormenting the fly. In the fall, he put up some elderberry wine, the sack of the berries dripping in the closet doorway, or make his own home brew in the crock that sat in the pantry. While it was brewing, both Cowie and Mrs. Ahern walked around the house on tiptoe, were careful about drafts, and never slammed the icebox doors. Any one of these things might cloud the beer or be the reason it exploded in the bottle. In the ceiling of the basement, broken beer bottle glass glittered like gems. Kawi was allowed to sniff this brew when it was open, but fortunately he was not allowed to taste it. Mr. Ahern always made it in the fall and winter and then threw most of it out in the summer. If it was weak, it could be opened and poured down the sink, but as a rule, it was strong and had to be buried like something that had died. In Cowie's opinion, it was all worthwhile. The beer was put in sacks, cemented come in, and then Kawi and Mr. Ahern, late Sunday evening in the Model T Ford he had worked on all winter, would drive out in the country east of Des Moines and bury the sacks in a grove of willows. Kawi was the hole sinking like a grave in the acetylene lamps of the car. Kawi was horrified and fascinated. Until they were back in the house, and in bed. He hardly knew he had been eaten by mosquitoes. Nor would he ever know how many times he dreamed of it all blowing up, or what strange monsters sprouted on the grave where they had planted bottles. Mr. Ahern's car was a Model T Touring with brass lamps and straps to hold the fenders, the crank in a leather sling like a penis sheath. That observation came later, of course, as did most of Cowie's observations. Photographs he had taken but not looked at carefully at the time. The car was kept in a shed attached to the house with a wood-burning stove to warm it. A good mechanic, a man who knew about presses, Mr. Ahern spent a year taking the car apart, putting shipping tags on all the separate pieces with a number or letter that told him where it belonged. The floor beneath it and the walls around it were covered with hundreds of bolts, screws, and pieces that refused, for reasons that were not clear, to go back in the order they had come off. Mr. Ahern was patient. With a good fire burning, he might work on it his whole night off. Some days he would come home with a friend, a mechanic, who had more experience with cars than he had. And after a good breakfast of ham and eggs, they would go to work instead of to bed. In one way or another, for one reason or another, one part or another was always overlooked. After working all day putting something together, they would have to keep working and take it apart. Cowie was not allowed to watch them due to the language they were disposed to use. All these days, Cowie went to school, but it hardly seemed to matter. He was good at history, poor on fractions, finished high in the music memory contest, and had a crush on the girl who played the cello and wore bows in her hair. Little it mattered, his real life was in the kitchen with Mrs. Ahern, who walked around in her stockings to keep from disturbing Mr. Ahern's sleep. It was for Cowie she prepared the sort of breakfast a growing boy should have and hadn't been getting. Hot chocolate, a boiled egg if he could eat it, and a large bowl of oatmeal whether he could eat it or not. When he appeared in the morning, carrying the shoes he would not put on till breakfast was over, Mrs. Ahern would be standing at the stove, slowly stirring oatmeal. Thanks to her corset, her slip hung around her like the hood around the bird's cage, showing no more than the run in her stockings when she stooped. Seated, her hair pinned up, she gave the impression of a tall woman. But only in the rocker did her feet ever touch the floor. Within a year, Cowie grew so she could pin his collar without stooping. But he had to walk around her, as he would a stove. She was thick but not deep-bosomed. It was her slope he inclined on when she hugged him, his hands gripping a rib of her corset at the sides. Up close, her face was all nose, and why, when she had her teeth out, Mr. Ahern himself didn't recognize her when she stepped through the door. On holidays, Cowie's father, driving his Studebaker Touring with the side curtains on the driver's side, would stop by with a box of chocolate-coated cherries for his sister and something educational for his son, an Erector set, say, or a book he could read when he got a year or two older. His father's voice was too big for the house, his hat always caught on the bracket of the gas jet, and the rug showed wear from the way he sat and scraped his feet. Cowie was always afraid that a chair would break when he sat on it. Mr. Ahern looked like a midget when he came in from the bedroom with his suspenders hanging, and Cowie's father pushed up from his chair. Fear of hitting something led him to draw his head in, his shoulders hunched. He had the big feet and bad legs Cowie would soon enough have himself, which led him to sigh as he sat down, almost groan when he arose. Mrs. Ahern was proud of her brother's bigness, but relieved when he left the house, holding on to the post as he let himself down the steps. Cowie, too, was proud, since the talk always centered on how fast he, Cowie, was growing, and although a boy, he was wearing a man-sized shoes. Mr. Ahern's caps would no longer fit on his head. Coming on holidays, when people were home or sitting out on the steps and the porch swings, his father also made a sizable impression on the neighborhood. After each visit, Cowie's stock rose. A girl named Lillian, daughter of a mailman who could outrun Cowie when they played Run Sheep Run, looked on him with different eyes when she saw how big he would loom as a man. But it would pass. Objects would resume their normal scale. Lillian Eichler would look at him soon with her mocking eyes. Strangest of all, Cowie took part in all this as he did in the seventh grade pageant at the school, where he was Little John, Robin Hood's friend, and stood with a stave to club down the villains. He enjoyed it, but never for a moment did he believe in it. Even while his father sat in the living room chair, blocked the door at the table in the kitchen, or filled the porch when he stood there laughing, or attracted all eyes when he cranked his car, even then the image of his father did not displace that of Mr. Ahern, the little man with a knotty twist of muscle in his jaw. When his father's booming voice had left the house, a curtain seemed to ring down on a performance that Cowie enjoyed, but never seriously confused with life. Mr. Ahern, indeed, coming home from work as the sun rose, managed to impose on his bass-ackward life the order of life. In this orbit, Cowie was included, seldom feeling at his ease with people who went to bed when Mr. Ahern went to work, or with cars that were actually assembled from their manifold parts. How long or how short did he live in this world? 2, 3, 4 years? Where time was worn inside out like a sock, such time was no help. It seemed to have no duration, being like the swing and tick of time in the clock at the school, or the drip of water in the pan under the icebox, or the clop-clop of the milk horse coming down the hill in the morning, announcing the end rather than the beginning of Mr. Ahern's day. On such a timeless world, of course, something was bound to impinge. It came in the form of sand, tons of sand, in wagons drawn by horses. These wagons came down the alley and dumped the gleaming stuff in the Ahern backyard. The time had come, that is, for the alley to be paved. This went on for a week, dozens of wagons each day, until the Ahern yard was like a patch of desert or a beach from where the water had withdrawn. One single cottonwood stump rose out of it. Beached forever, it seemed, was Mr. Ahern's Model T in its shed, the unassembled parts coated with a fine powder of sand. What had been put together would once more have to be taken apart. But that was incidental. Of some importance was the circus that came over the 4th of July, which Cowie's father, paying his holiday to visit, took him to. Cowie's eye had always been for the freaks. They remained on his mind's eye to blur the big show under the tent. In the summer heat, his black shoes dusty, vaguely sick with pop and spun sugar candy, Cowie had stood silent while his father had bought him a tiny lizard on a leash of ribbon to be worn like a flower on his lapel. The creature adapted its coloring according to the suit it was worn on. Cowie wore green, so iridescently green it was. In a shoebox, however, one saw him clearly in just what parts of the flies he had eaten. Flies that Cowie spent most of the day trapping alive. For a week he fattened, showing little taste for assorted bugs. One summer evening, Cowie and the creature sat in the sand pile snaring flies together, a drop of honey serving as the bait. The neighboring yards and the alley were in shadow, but the Ahern yard glowed with sand. In it, Cowie had lost both marbles and coins. Periodically, he turned up buckets of sand, looking for both. That was what he was doing, sifting sand through his fingers when he noticed that the creature was missing. Bailey, his name was. Two flies, but no lizards, occupied the box. Experience had taught Cowie not to panic, but little good it did him. He saw nothing. Perfect as the light was for finding coins, it seemed ideal for concealing Bailey. Only a shadow would have revealed him, and there was no sun. Cowie crawled about, calling the name softly, feeling certain that Bailey would understand his error and that life with Cowie, dull as it was better than death in a sandpile. But he found nothing. In the evening, he lit candles and looked again. Mrs. Ahern forced him to go to bed, but he slept in snatches, tormented by dreaming. And he was awake when the milk horse came down the hill. Half an hour before dawn, in his nightshirt, Cowie sneaked out to look for Bailey. The faint glow of dawn was in the sky. The surface of the sand was cool, but warm underneath. He was out there when Mr. Ahern came home, and Mrs. Ahern noticed that his bed was empty. Both of their faces appeared at the window above the sink, open to stir up a draft. Mrs. Ahern called him, then explained to Mr. Ahern what had happened and why he was out there. Even Cowie was aware of how strange he must look. A fat boy in a nightshirt that did not provide protective coloration. Mr. Ahern was a man of few words, and he took a moment to gather them together. Even before Cowie heard them, he knew they would echo through his life. "For Christ's sake, kid," he said, "when will you give up?" Smoke from his cigar caught on the screen like bits of veil. The question was sensible, and time was allowed for Cowie to reflect on it and make an answer. Did he sense how imponderable it was? Was there something in Cowie older than his boyhood that gathered the import of such a question and knew that his life would never come up with an answer to it? In any case, he made none. A flood of emotion filled his eyes and throat like water, and he was there on his hands and knees in the sand pile until Mrs. Ahern led him back to bed. Oddly enough, it was Mr. Ahern who gave up first. The day after Thanksgiving, he came home not at sunrise, but late afternoon, more than normally deliberate in his walk. His coat flapped open, the newspaper he carried whacked on it with a slap. Mr. Ahern had spent the morning calling the men with whom he was friendly. Neither of them, so it seemed, had showed up themselves. This was unusual to say the least, but Mrs. Ahern hinted that it was not unheard of. No, there had been such goings on when they lived in Duluth. At that time, Mrs. Ahern had drawn a line, and Mr. Ahern had vowed not to cross it. If he crossed it, Mrs. Ahern would take matters into her own hands, which she did. When Mr. Ahern had not appeared by lunchtime, she got out the wicker bags with the straps that she had not used since they went to Kansas City on their honeymoon. In one, she found a pin she thought she had lost, a real butterfly made into a brooch. Moths had eaten it, however, in spite of the guarantee. All afternoon, Cowie helped her to take clothes from the hangers and air them out, then fold them over papers to keep them from wrinkling and pack them in the bags. He had to sit on both of them to get them shut. His own clothes, except what he had on, went into a fiber case that would expand. Mrs. Ahern dressed herself in the hat with the veil and the button shoes that almost killed her, then sat with her bags beside her in the living room with the shades drawn. When Mr. Ahern arrived, whenever that might be, she would quietly ask him to call her a cab and help with the bags. They would go directly to the Burlington station and take the next train, whenever that might be, to her brother, Cowie's father, in Sioux City. From the station, they would send Mr. Ahern a telegram. In Sioux City, she would think things over and go, if necessary, to her sister in Duluth or her Aunt Irene, who ran a large boarding house and could always use help. Cowie's future seemed vague as he sat there in the new green suit Mrs. Ahern had bought him, the collar already wrinkled on his new shirt. On his large, flat feet were the man-sized walkover shoes. A new suit of underwear tickled on his back and made him squirm. He had been too stunned by events to think of his shoe skates in the basement, his cigar box of marbles, and a pair of real earphones that needed only a crystal set to make them useful. He wound the Victrola, changed the needle, but did not laugh as usual at Harry Lauder. When Mr. Ahern's step was heard on the hill, he wore metal caps on the heels to save them. Cowie would have fled if the door hadn't already been bolted. Inside of his winter underwear, his body was cold. White-faced, her lips blue, Mrs. Ahern gripped the hardwood arms of the rocker as she waited for Mr. Ahern's step on the porch. It did not come. Had he walked right past the house? No, Cowie saw his shadow on the blind as he took the crosscut across the lawn and brushed the barren branches of the lilac bush. What was he up to? They heard him swinging wide, the doors on the shed at the rear. For a moment, there was no other sound but the creak of that door, loose on its hinge. Then a metallic crash that raised Cowie from the sofa as if thrown from a saddle. Mrs. Ahern pressed the veil into her open mouth. Neither moved. However, the few minutes as it proved to be later, it required Mr. Ahern to demolish the Model T with an axe. The last few blows were not so noisy since he had turned to the post that held up the roof. It collapsed on what was left of the car, burying it. At a safe distance, neighbors had gathered to watch Mr. Ahern settle a problem that had been on his mind for more than 5 years. The alley had been paved. The tons of gleaming sand were gone from the yard, leaving a gritty surface that pitted the soles of Cowie's shoes. Finding the rear door bolted, Mr. Ahern gave it a whack that cracked it open. Then he came in without a word and sprawled on the bed. He was in no condition to call a cab or help Mrs. Ahern with her bags. And when his breathing got noisy, she went in and took off his clothes. Cowie remembered his shoes sticking up at the end with the soles pitted like sandpaper and the quiet in the house after she got him undressed and rolled on his face. A few minutes later, she took off her hat and shoes and lay down herself. A few weeks later, Cowie's father thought it might be nice if Cowie visited his grandmother in Missouri, where he stayed on to help with the chores until spring. He never saw his Aunt Martha again, nor Mr. Ahern, although he always got a card from them at Christmas, nor did he ever get the shoe skates he left in the basement, or the King Edward cigar box full of marbles. Some other kid got the marbles. Almost 30 years later, not knowing when to give up, Cowie got the box.